Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from KRUULP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of the show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show, looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are its traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. Please get some notebook, paper, and pen so you can take notes during the show. First, let's look at some debt-related news and facts for the week. I'm continuing this week with an article called 10 Things Credit Card Companies Won't Say in Smart Money Magazine by Nancy Nahl Derringer. We're on number 6. So you think you're paid in full? Well, not necessarily. Banks generally calculate interest charges in one of two ways on credit cards, based on average daily balance or on something called two-cycle billing. The latter, which more card issuers are now adopting, penalizes customers who carry a balance even if it's only on occasion. Here's how it works. Say you start with your month having a zero balance and charge an amount that you don't pay off in full at the end of the month. If your card uses the average daily balance method to calculate interest, you are charged nothing for the month you made the purchase and interest only for subsequent months in which payment is outstanding. With two-cycle billing, interest charges begin with the day you make the purchase. Banks now defend the two-cycle billing as correcting the true interest charges for credit card purchases. Ron Brooks at National City Corp says it's a way to make sure credit card users pay interest should they suddenly go from being transactors, those who pay off every month, to revolvers, those who carry a balance. One way to avoid the issue is to stay away from cards that use two-cycle billing to calculate interest charges and stick with those that go by average daily balance. Unfortunately, it's not a permanent solution. Your card provider can switch to two-cycle billing with just 15 days' notice, so you'll have to keep checking. Another thing that credit card companies don't say is we're accepted anywhere on the globe, but our exchange rates are from Planet Ripoff. In recent years, plastic has all but replaced the traveler's check as the preferred method for making purchases abroad. Credit cards are widely accepted overseas, and they can be used in ATMs all over the world to dispense cash in the currency of whatever country you're visiting. But beware of hidden charges. Some banks have recently raised the rates on currency conversion from 1% to 3%. On top of that, ATM usage has its own fees attached. Consumers Union recommends studying your card's policies on foreign currency purchases before you leave home, then adjusting your spending accordingly. Cards issued by smaller banks, for example, may have lower fees, as do certain brand name cards. American Express, which has long positioned itself as a card for travelers, charges a flat 2%. Another thing that credit card companies don't say is that we close early on payment due dates. Card statements are crystal clear about what day your payment is due, but they're not so forthcoming about what time on that due date. Some banks have triggered consumer complaints by setting a 9 a.m. deadline on the posted payment date, essentially before the mail arrives. Chi-Chi Wu, an attorney from the National Consumer Law Center, says that a number of class action lawsuits have succeeded in getting most banks to push back their payment deadline to 2 p.m., the traditional banker's closing hour, the time by which most mail delivery is complete. Even so, a spokesperson for the American Bankers Association is unsympathetic, saying bills are due upon receipt and that banks spend a lot of money giving consumers options like paying by phone, paying online, and automatic bill pay. I just don't understand why late payment is still an issue for people, she says. Pay your bill on time, it's easy. She does have a point. If you can't allow plenty of time for U.S. mail delivery, you can always take advantage of an online or pay-by-phone option. And if you're really in a pinch, another alternative is to send your payment overnight, worth it if it means avoiding a $30 late penalty. But if you go that route, check the promised time of delivery. The standard end-of-business arrival might not do the trick. Another point is, our whims are legally binding. You may think you've signed up for a credit card with terrific incentives, a low APR, and just the right mix of perks and fees to suit you. But don't get too comfortable. Your card issuer can alter the terms of your once-perfect agreement at any time, as long as it provides you with advance written notice of as little as 15 days. The biggest secret in the credit card industry is they are very thinly regulated, says Wu of the National Consumer Law Center. Consumer groups report that this practice is a particular pet peeve with credit card holders, and for obvious reasons. But an American Banker Association spokesperson takes a stab at defending the practice. A credit purchase is an unsecured loan. It's the riskiest sort of lending we do, which is why it's expensive. The banks have to protect themselves. She adds that since credit card lending is a highly competitive marketplace, unhappy customers are almost always able to seek alternatives. So how can you protect yourself from being blindsided? In short, vigilance. Pay attention to all the mail you get from your credit card company, Wu urges, even if it looks insignificant. And finally, point 10. Go ahead and exceed your credit limit. We like that. Contrary to popular belief, a purchase that puts you over your credit limit won't necessarily be declined. But you might wish it had been, since it could bump your interest rate into the stratosphere. Lee Baker, a data entry clerk in Oakland, California, found that out the hard way when she exceeded the limit on her Visa card, and her interest rate skyrocketed to 29.9%. The sudden increase was among the factors that ultimately pushed her into credit counseling and a debt management plan. I have to find another $1,000 a month to dig my way out, Barker says. I'm looking at a second job. Adding insult to injury, banks often levy a so-called over-limit fee against maxed out cardholders, roughly a $30 penalty every month your balance remains above the credit limit. An American Banker Association spokesperson says that consumers would rather deal with the fee than the embarrassment of being declined. But consumer advocate Travis Plunkett of the Consumer Federation of America is having none of it. Over-limit fees, he contends, are another simple way for banks to make money at the expense of the unwary. If banks are willing to accept charges over their cardholders' limits, Plunkett says, then they should accept the profit that comes from the increased interest charges and leave it at that. So those are 10 things that credit card companies won't say. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Now I'd like to continue with the second segment of the show, where we look at a review of ideas on how to deal with your debt situation, your money situation, past, present, and future, getting a much more balanced budget. This has been a show that has gone on for about 48 weeks, and each week we have looked at very, very important issues and ways to deal with those debt-related issues. As I start each show, I want to give an important credit because the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in these programs are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of Professor Elizabeth Warren from Harvard and her daughter Amelia Warren Tyagi, two of America's leading champions for debtors, and I highly recommend their books, All Your Worth and The Two Income Trap. We have recently been looking at a number of important issues, and you can review those issues as all the issues in this program by going to the archives at www.kruufm.com. Look under Life and Debt, and you can actually listen to all of the prior programs. Last week, we were looking at the golden rules of love and money, reviewing them, which we have gone over in the past. We're looking at long-term relationships that are marriages or partnerships that are really committed for life in the ideal situation, and how money issues relate to that relationship. And we are on a review of rule number 6, which is fight fair. Oftentimes when there are relationship arguments, money comes up and it really isn't money. There's something else going on, and money is just an issue that is hit upon, but it's not really the causal issue. We discussed that last week. But what happens when money really is what you're fighting about? And that is partially due to the reality that people do have different tastes, different priorities, and you may disagree with your mate's choices. That's normal. Normal couples have different kinds of opinions about things, and it's not all a completely, absolutely perfect fit, and that's reality. So here are the ground rules for fighting fair about money. One very important thing is that you don't hit below the belt. If you know your partner feels deeply humiliated over something, for example, losing his job, losing her advantage in moving up in the workforce because of something that happened, anything where somebody really did make a mistake, you must never use this as a weapon when you're having a battle, a fight. People are mortally sensitive on certain topics, and you don't want to hurt them. You don't want to hurt your loved one about something that can bring out a deep scar and, in fact, worsen it in terms of not only that issue, but in terms of your relationship. And it doesn't matter that it's true or that it is something that happened a long time ago. You just don't bring up hurtful things when you fight over money. Even when you get mad, there needs to be some limits, because then this nurtures and cultivates the relationship regardless of the money issues, and then you can deal with the money issues in a strong relationship, in a healthy relationship. Whereas when the relationship is challenged on many levels, that means that the money issue can be a death knell to that relationship. So don't ever hit below the belt. And another thing is, don't blame your partner for joint decisions. If you signed your name on the dotted line for a mortgage, car payment, whatever, furniture, it's too late to attack your partner for getting a bad deal. Your mortgage may be in a really unfortunate circumstance right now with the current economy, but the moment you agree to go along with it, you really effectively forfeited the right to blame your partner if the thing didn't work out. If a joint deal goes south, then own up to your half of that bum decision, and you are just as responsible. So you would not bring that up when you're having a debate, i.e. a fight. You want to fight fair. Another important issue is, you don't make giant generalizations. So this name-calling kind of thing, or making sweeping statements like, you always spend too much, or you never are careful with money, etc. It's not really nice, it's not very useful, and the truth is, it's not even true. It's really not part of a relationship and reality situation to say never or always. Whatever thing your mate did do, you can't really point at it as the critical thing in the money relationship. There are a thousand other things that people do that are dumb, and your mate didn't do them. Just think, the sweeping statements about how someone always overspends or is never careful really aren't true. But they can transform something small into something quite huge. These words will turn a minor spat into a raging battle quicker than you can even imagine. So hold your tongue. Don't say something because you can't take it back. It goes out there and it creates a scar. It's damaging and it is not fighting fairly. And then a final point in the fight fair scenario is don't take every difference as a personal attack, a personal insult. Differences about money are not intended as attacks. People have different opinions about money. If one of you doesn't want to spend a lot of money on a particular recreational item or a gift item, for example, he doesn't want to buy you fresh flowers, and he says, well, they just die. It doesn't mean that he doesn't love you, or if she would rather go out to dinner rather than cook, and she thinks that that's important because she is, quote-unquote, a lousy cook, that doesn't mean that she doesn't love you and want to take care of you and nurture you. It just is a personal difference. Sometimes money decisions are just about money, not an expression of your innermost soul and your innermost intimacy. So you take the sting out of differences by recognizing they are just that, differences. You acknowledge them and you just move on. So again, the issue of fight fair is don't hit below the belt. Don't blame your partner for joint decisions. Don't make giant generalizations. And don't take every difference as a personal insult. The next golden rule that I want to look at is rule number 7 in review, divide and conquer. So we think that financial equality means we share the decision-making, we share the responsibility. On the other hand, it does not mean that you have to share the chores equally. We have to be realistic and face it that partners have different temperaments and different talents. One can be hyper-organized and the other one not so organized. One is really great with numbers and finances, and the other is very doubtful about simple math. One may be very fascinated by finances, while the other experiences a wave of nausea every time the business news comes on. So there are huge differences in the way relationship partners have temperaments and talents. And generally, after an amount of time of a relationship, you will see, particularly as decades start going by in these kinds of intimate relationships and marriages, that your roles tend to sort out on their own. However, if you're in a new relationship, you have to divvy up the chores, and that can be a lot more complicated, especially if you aren't married, you don't have a permanent partnership, and your financial lives are still separate. So here are a few tips for dividing and conquering when your money is mostly separate. But before I get into that, if you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. And I'm speaking of divide and conquering, and what I'm saying here is that if you aren't married and your finances are somewhat separate, these are a few tips. Start by deciding how much each will contribute to the joint expenses. If you've been taking this program coursework, you will come to the conclusion that you really should look at the balanced money formula as a guideline. If your income is a lot higher or a lot lower than your partner's, that will mean that the 50% issue is something that has to be factored in. You both contribute the same percentage of your income to the bare necessities for your rent, transportation, food, and the like. And you both keep the same percentage for your wants. Your bare necessities, 50%, your wants, 30%, and your savings is 20%. And from that, of course, to get that amount, each one of you puts in 50% of your income into that category. So that makes it all even. So that's the financial side of it. But what about the chores side of it? Unmarried couples often decide that they're splitting the expenses 50-50, so they should split the chores 50-50. But remember, financial chores are no different than all the other chores around the house. One of you may be better at it than the other. So if your partner turns green when faced with a checkbook, don't fight it. Just ask him or her to take out the trash while you pay the bills. So instead of trying to split all the financial chores 50-50, divide responsibilities in a way that makes sense. If he is more organized, then he should keep the records. If she likes to negotiate, then she should shop for the car, for example. And if you are the only one willing to do what it takes to get your money in balance, then, like Nike says, just do it. You're both 100% responsible, but you can't do 100% of the tasks. Obviously, each one can't do all of it. So you have to do what makes sense for you as a couple. And always remember, even if you have divided the responsibilities in a way that makes sense, you still will be 100% responsible, and if it's not getting done, you can talk about it, renegotiate, but always remember that you see the job, you do the job, you stay out of the misery, and that will help you not only with your finances, but in the long run with your relationship. And then the final golden rule in love and money is learn the art of compromise. We can say that you're doing your honest to goodness best to be happy, healthy, and have a good money relationship. And yet you can still disagree, not on just little stuff, but on big things. The stuff you just can't cover with your fun money, your want money. For example, one of you wants a bigger house, but that's not a want issue as much as it is a bare necessity issue and a big issue. He or she may think it's time for a better car, a newer car, a faster car. These are really big decisions with no amount of good intentions that can easily make them go away. So what do? The important thing here is that you need to keep communicating, keep talking, start talking, keep on talking. Talk doesn't cost anything, but a lot can be accomplished from that communication. One of the nice things about big decisions is that there can be a lot to talk about, so you keep the conversation going over a long period of time. You can also do a lot of research on it by looking at the internet, by going into consumer reports about this kind of situation that you're wanting to purchase. You can ask your friends about their similar purchases. You bring more information back to the table and open up another conversation. And once it gets open, you just keep talking about it until you both feel 100% responsible for the final decision. It's very, very critical. The second part of this golden rule is that in the art of compromise, you put time on your side. Sometimes you want something big, and it really is just a matter of timing. A nice vacation this year, remodel the kitchen next year, more room for the kids, a nicer car. You can actually layer these things over time. Instead of saying one or the other, decide that you will actually put together a plan and save for both. You get something and your partner gets something. It certainly does take longer, but you recognize that both of you have legitimate wants and you can work together for them. That realization is priceless in your relationship. and it will eventually get you what you want too. That's bigger than just the small change, fun money kind of wants. And then finally, in The Art of Compromise, we focus on the big picture. So even after you do the communication, you put time on your side, if you find yourself still squabbling, well, you have to take a step back and keep an eye on the bigger picture. If you can't agree on everything, there are some very big things you can agree on, and those really are quality of life issues, keeping a roof over your heads, growing old together in comfort and dignity. Even if you don't agree on how much money you should be allocating here and there into your retirement account, what kind of house to be living in, etc., you want to have those basic dignified values. You both want to ensure safety for your loved ones, your children, and you really hopefully want to stop fighting. You both want to stop worrying about money. So kinds of issues that are drawing your attention onto them, and you're putting a lot of attention on them, sometimes you just have to step back and put those issues which are creating disagreements into a bigger perspective. When a relationship has become bruised over the subject of money, reminding yourself of the common ground that you both stand on and the love that is related to that common ground will certainly heal the situation and give you stability. It will anchor you in what can appear to be a turbulent ocean. But that turbulence is on the surface, so you have to go deeper with each other in your relationship on all the different layers of your relationship, and you will see that there are many, many things that you share which are invaluable in your relationship, and putting your attention on those things will help that relationship to be solid, stable, and in a proper perspective. So that's it on The Art of Compromise. Keep talking, put time on your side, and focus on the big picture. And that was the 8th golden rule regarding love and money. So in conclusion, in this area, really the heart of a relationship is often greatly affected by money. Money can be the hardest kind of intimacy. Money is often wrapped up in attitudes and values shaped from our birth and our environment. It sometimes feels as if everything we stand for can be expressed in terms of how we spend money. Negotiating about money intimacy can be as difficult as anything you will ever face together. The differences between you and your partner can be subtle and hard to interpret, and in fact, they are as if landmines. Worse yet, money issues, particularly in the current economy, seem to be pervasive everywhere. Even if you're in the kind of relationship where you never talk about money, you will still develop a money relationship, and it is for better or for worse. Whether you discuss it every day or shroud it in silence, you and your mate will decide who works, who spends, who pays which bills, how much debt you carry, and how much you can save, all of which forms your money relationship. And what we have been trying to do here is to make every money relationship better. No matter where you're starting from, it really is possible to improve the role that money plays in your relationship. You have to give it a try, though. Even if you're not convinced that all of these ideas will work in your relationship, give it your honest to goodness effort. Get on the path to balancing your money, and get on the path to a truly joyful, fulfilling, rewarding relationship that you and your partner deserve, and money will actually blossom in that kind of fertile field. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from KRUULP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.